Friends, these meetings, these three lectures are being sponsored by the Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of Santa Monica in response to the request from the Universal House of Justice in its Rezvan message this year, in which they ask the Baha'is to understand more deeply the teachings by reviewing three of the letters from Shoghi Effendi that compose the volume we know now as the World Order of Baha'u'llah. That set of letters, three of them, will be discussed over the period of these three lectures. The first letter was written in 1931 and entitled The Goal of a New World Order. The second letter, written in 1933, is entitled America and the Most Great Peace. And the third letter, written in 1936, is entitled The Unfoldment of World Civilization. You may have possibly read these letters. If you haven't, we encourage you to read them because they will not be read in their entirety, of course, tonight or the following two Thursday nights. Amin's plan is to tonight speak about Shoghi Effendi, the author of these three letters, and from the viewpoint of both a personal visit with Shoghi Effendi, once when he was a child at the age of 8 with his parents in 1934, and again as an adult in 1955, December 1955. So he will bring a personal touch to the author of these letters, and we hope that tonight that subject will comprise a good part of his first lecture, Stories about Shoghi Effendi. We hope you enjoy this event, and we will, following his remarks, we will go to the multipurpose room and have tea and coffee and cookies. May I invite Amin to come forward? Amin is a Baha'i in Santa Monica Baha'i community.
Sheila, you're generous in your promises. I hope I can deliver some of them. Well, the House of Justice has asked us to look at these letters of Shoghi Effendi, which were written about 70 years ago. Ah, that's good. In order to better understand some of the fundamentals of our faith, and also relate them better to what is going on in the world, in order to assess where we stand in our efforts in the five-year plan and how best to make a success of our efforts. Now, when you think of that, things that were written 70 years ago have retained their not only their relevance, but their immediacy for our time. That in itself is a good starting point for our discussions. And there, in understanding of that, that here was someone whose powers of analysis, whose acute insights into the nature of the human predicament was such that it continues to be valid, not only after 70 years, but for centuries to come. And that should be our starting point with understanding of the nature of the person of the guardian and the nature of the institution of the guardianship. Now, I want to start by posing for you something that may sound like a curiosity, that is someone who more than anyone else in the world has helped us understand the world order of Baha'u'llah, has defined it, has delineated it, has set its shape, dimensions, and its pulse for us. No one as clearly, as beautifully as Shoghi Effendi, guardian of the Baha'i faith. And then think that in all the writings of Baha'u'llah, where we have the charter for that world order, the Tablet of Carmel, the Tablet of the World, portions of the Kitab al-Aqdas, the Tablets of Ishraqat, Tajalliyat, Tarazat, all these weighty writings of Baha'u'llah, which together provide us with the shape, the structure of his world order, there is no mention of either a guardian or an institution of guardianship. Now, we are only 160 years into the history of the faith, which is a very short span of time. And as I get older, that perspective becomes even more apparent to me when I realize that I have lived half of the whole Baha'i era. I've been alive in this world, you know. Not that I made much sense or contributed much to its development, but it's a short span. And it's indeed not easy to stand back and take a kind of a historical view or a perspective. And yet I'm going to be foolish enough to attempt that a little bit for you tonight. And I hope that you realize that I'm doing just that. It's a personal attempt at understanding of this history, which despite its briefness, has been full of ups and downs, full of crises, full of abrupt turns, from the martyrdom of its herald to imprisonment, exile of its founder, to persecution of its exemplar, to unexpected and passing of its guardian, to the seemingly baffling prospect that the Baha'is found themselves in 1957 of no will from Shoghi Effendi and therefore no way for the continuation. So you put all of these things together and you see that it's been a history of cataclysms, of crises, of abrupt changes, and of course through these the pattern of crisis and triumph emerges. That in fact, after each one of these great calamities, there is a tremendous forward leap in the development of the cause. So with all of that, I would like to be allowed to make this historical observation that maybe in the centuries hence, in the future, when we look back, we see this 36-year span of guardianship that we had from 1921 to 1957 as a most significant interlude in the unfoldment of the not only the administrative order, but the fundamentals of the world order of Baha'u'llah. One which was necessitated by a number of causes, just as unexpectedly it began, and just as unexpectedly it ended. What ended was the person, you know, that is the the line of guardians, but as the House of Justice has clearly and beautifully explained to us, the institution of the guardianship lives in the writings of Shoghi Effendi, some of which we are directed to study with great care now, and which obviously the House of Justice itself continues to pore over and to study. And so we can see that in 1921, the authorized interpreter of his teachings, of Baha'u'llah's teachings, that is, the person of Abdul Baha, realizing the condition of the world and of the condition of the Baha'i communities in that world, that some measure of further further consecration, further deepening of the structure of the center of the covenant was necessary, and therefore in his tablets of will and testament he gave us the institution of the guardianship, and he appointed his grandson Shoghi Effendi as the first guardian. It came as much as a surprise to the person of Shoghi Effendi as it did to all the other Baha'is in the world. I've been asked to sort of share with you what I was privileged to observe the person of Shoghi Effendi. I want to even do a little more than that, share with you things that I heard from wonderful Baha'is who were acquainted with Shoghi Effendi at a much earlier time. And particularly, I want to tell you one story related to me by a gentleman who knew Shoghi Effendi during his student days at Oxford, and who not only knew him well, but who was really asked by Abdul Baha to act as a kind of a, I wouldn't say caretaker, but in Persian we have a wonderful term, doesn't exact equivalent doesn't exist in English, as a lale, a person who really is in charge of your needs, of your things. Where letters came from Haifa via this gentleman, funds were sent for Shoghi Effendi, it came via him. Times on weekends when Shoghi Effendi didn't have classes at Oxford, he spent in home of this gentleman. This gentleman's name was Ziaullah Astarzadeh, a wonderful Baha'i of Azerbaijani origin who had grown up in Ashgabat. I met him in 1949 for the first time in England, and the most amusing and wonderful human being who spoke language mixed of Persian, Turkish, Russian, and English, all in a thickest Turkish accent. And the story that he told was about receiving the news of appointment of Shoghi Effendi. And I want to share it with you because it was in many ways indicative of the way that practically majority of Baha'is throughout the world reacted. He said that it so happened that when the telegram from the greatest holy leaf came to England announcing the passing of Abdul Baha, he, that is Mr. Astarzadeh, was away from London and therefore was not able to immediately get in touch with Shoghi Effendi. Shoghi Effendi heard it through Mr. Esselmont and quickly packed up and left for Haifa, so that when Mr. Astarzadeh returned to London and found this, Shoghi Effendi was already gone. But nobody knew anything other than Abdul Baha has passed away. What the tablets of the will and testament say was not known yet. So Mr. Astarzadeh said, I said to myself, this is a time of crisis. I'm sure that there is need for a lot of work in Haifa, and I better go there quickly and be at the service of the greatest holy leaf and the Holy Family for whatever they need, because their hands are going to be full with the preparation for the election establishment of the House of Justice. This is what all the Baha'is thought. That, you know, when you have someone like Abdu'l-Bahá in your midst, you don't even like to think that someday he won't be there, you know. That, but it's a fact of human nature. And if anyone entertained what happens after, you know, the thought of what is going to happen after Abdu'l-Bahá, almost to a person, everyone thought, well, that's when the House of Justice will be formed. And if you read the writings of Baha'u'llah, that's the conclusion that you come to. So I have to go and be of help with the preparations of the election of a formation of the House of Justice. And I packed up and I left London to go to Paris, to go to Marseille, to get on board ship to sail to Haifa. In Paris, I met with a group of American Baha'is who were resident of Paris, and they said, have you heard? A telegram has come from the greatest holy leaf that the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá has been opened and Shoghi Effendi is appointed the guardian of the faith. Mr. Asgharzadeh said, I thought the world had come on my head. I had a crisis of faith. How could it be? This 22-year-old young man with whom I was bantering up until last week, and how could, I mean, what guardianship, what? No, it must be a mistake. It must be a test that this is, you know, somehow to test the firmness of the Baha'is. And sure enough, the House of Justice will be formed soon. And so, said, after actually 24 hours of high fever, I was so wrought up with this agitation that I was laid up in my hotel. But finally, I got over it and I started preparations to go to Marseille. And in the meantime, in my mind, I'm trying to construct the steps that have to be taken now for the establishment of the House of Justice. And I think in my own mind, says, well, every Baha'i community in the world will elect one representative, and they will send to serve as a member of the Universal House of Justice. And I was a native of Ashgabat, so I started out with my own home community of Ashgabat. Who is worthy of being a member of the Universal House of Justice from the Baha'i community of Ashgabat? That's easy. Sayyid Mehdi Golpayegani is the elder, respected, white-beard, you know, member of that community. He's a deep scholar of the faith. He has received many tablets of praise commendation from Abdu'l-Bahá. So Ashgabat will send Sayyid Mehdi Golpayegani to the Universal House of Justice. After I had settled this in my mind, he said, well, he, of course, will have to go into this Universal House of Justice and consult with members, with the representatives of other Baha'i communities from the United States, from Germany, from Britain. In what language is Mr. Sayyid Mehdi Golpayegani going to have these consultations at the Universal House of Justice? He's fluent in Persian. He knows Arabic. He knows some Turkish. He may even know a few words of Russian, but that's not going to enable him to deal with the representatives of these other communities. So I think what's going to happen? I go in my mind through the younger members of Ashgabat community who are who have a Western education and who know European languages, but none of them really has the stature, none of them has the ability to do this. So I figured that Well, this is, after all, the Baha'i world. Boundaries and localities are not going to be a hindrance. Ashgabat can have a representative that is not a resident or a native of Ashgabat. So they can reach out all through the Baha'i world and pick out someone. And so Ashgabat now is out looking for a representative who not only understands their language, that's Persian, but who can also speak with other people in English and in French and so forth and so on. And I keep thinking, and whom do I know? And I said, well, Ashgabat can ask Shoghi Effendi to be their representative. So it's okay. So, okay, Shoghi Effendi will go to the House of Justice as a representative of Ashgabat. Next, I go to the community next closest to me, and I know where I know. That's the largest Baha'i community in the world, and that's Persia. There again, there are very prominent Baha'is. There are some four hands of the cause alive, you know, and so forth. That, again, without realizing it, I first elect one of these respectable old gentleman, and then the same problem comes up. And again, I find that Persia also is having problem finding a suitable representative of international law with international qualifications. So I said, well, nobody says that two countries can't have the same representative. So he said, in my mind again, I said, okay, Shoghi Effendi can be representative of Persia also. And with that, you know, you have to visualize the humor of Mr. Asgharzadeh, who sometimes made fun of his own Turkish origins. You know? So I don't want to say anything for fear of offending possible Turks in the audience. But he said that after having gone through this process and finding out that about five different Baha'i communities in Ashgabat, in Persia, in England, in Germany, had all asked Shoghi Effendi to be their representative, then I had a tremendous, lightning hit my head. He said, what are you doing? You think Abdul Baha didn't know all of these things when he made this will and testament? So with this transformation, I began to be eased into the idea that maybe at this time the Baha'i world needs someone like Shoghi Effendi that can connect all of these communities together. So he said, I got to Marseille, I booked passage on a ship going to the Holy Land, and the first day on deck, I see a gentleman lying on one of those deck chairs, sort of sleeping with a book on his chest, with the cover of the book, it has the greatest name on it. So I went and tapped him on the shoulder and said, are you Baha'i? He said, yes. I introduced myself, and he introduced himself. My name is Consul Schwartz from Germany. And I'm going to Haifa. Greatest Holy Leaf has sent a telegram to various countries to send a representative to be of witnesses at the formal reading of the will and testament of Abdul Baha, and that's what I'm going. And Sassar said, yes, I'm going to the Holy Land too to help out whatever I can. And said, Consul Schwartz asked me, do you have permission to go? And he said, I was again struck. So, one needs permission. So, so I got off the ship in Alexandria, and I sent a telegram asking for permission, and answer immediately came from the Greatest Holy Leaf to come as soon as possible. And said, I finally arrived in Haifa and knocked on the door of Abdul Baha's house, and I was ushered in, and immediately the Greatest Holy Leaf herself came and said, oh, Ziaullah, I'm so glad that you came here. There's so much work. Shoghi Effendi really needs help. And just at this time, Shoghi Effendi himself appeared, and he embraced me, and he said, you're just in time. And he reached in his pocket and pulled out the will and testament tablets of Abdul Baha, the original ones. He said, sit down and make several copies. We need to send to the Baha'is in various parts of the world. And he said, now I'm sitting down and I'm reading the Will and Testament of Abdu'l-Bahá, and I'm getting to the sections where Abdu'l-Bahá describes Shoghi Effendi. And let me read to you just those words here. It says, oh, my loving friends, after the passing away of this wronged one, it is incumbent upon the Aghsan, the Afnan, and the sacred low tree, the hands of the cause of God, and the loved ones of the Abha beauty, to turn unto Shoghi Effendi, the youthful branch, branched from the two hallowed and sacred low trees, and the fruit grown from the union of the two offshoots of the tree of holiness. As he is the sign of God, the chosen branch, the guardian of the cause of God, he unto whom all the Ahsan, the Afnan, the hands of the cause, and his loved ones must turn. And further on, these words again describing O ye the faithful loved ones of Abdu'l-Bahá, it is incumbent upon you to take the greatest care of Shoghi Effendi, the twig that hath branched from and the fruit given forth by two hallowed and divine low trees, that no dust of despondency and sorrow may strain his radiant nature, that day by day he may wax greater in happiness, in joy and spirituality, and may grow to become even as a fruitful tree. So I was reading these words and I couldn't stop tears just flowing, so that I spoiled several of the copies that I was reading. So fortunately, I kept the original at a distance so that they wouldn't be harmed, but I had to restart, see. And this is how one very faithful, very close, the acquaintance, I should say, of Shoghi Effendi thought. And this was, as I said, more typical of larger number of Baha'is throughout the world, so that the coming into being of the institution of the guardianship and getting to know the person of Shoghi Effendi was something entirely unexpected Baha'i world. Now, we are fortunate that someone so uniquely qualified as Amatul-Bahá Ruhi Khanum has written a book about the life of Shoghi Effendi, a priceless pearl, you know. And it is one of the most valuable things that Ruhi Khanum, who did so many valuable services to this cause, has performed. And yet I want to say, with all due respect, that the picture that you get of Shoghi Effendi in the Priceless Pearl is not complete. And why do I say that? That is because it is essentially Shoghi Effendi viewed from the perspective of the West. If you add visage, the angle of vision of Shoghi Effendi from such places as Neiriz and Targhe and Qamsar and those villages in Persia and of Ishqabad and so forth together, then you will have a more complete picture of Abdu'l-Bahá. Well, I don't mean that that's a good idea. Are you bringing that water for me? I need it. Thank you very much. That's very good. When I speak to American friends or Western friends, I usually make this observation that the Shoghi Effendi that we know should be complimented by the Shoghi Effendi that the Baha'is of the Eastern world knew as well. And when I speak to Persian Baha'is especially, or Baha'is from the East, I have to make this same remark with a triple emphasis, because so much of the fundamental unique writings of Shoghi Effendi are in English. And their view of Shoghi Effendi without access to the Western side is also incomplete. If it is at all possible, I would like to urge you to try and merge this total global angle of vision of Shoghi Effendi, and then we can proceed with the study of these three letters. Shoghi Effendi, initially as a young boy and as a student, and he had absolutely no intimation that he would be appointed the guardian of the faith, thought of his future, of his services as a translator. He prepared himself essentially to be a good translator of the writings of Baha'u'llah and Abdul Baha from Arabic and Persian into primarily English, and he also was fluent in French, but he himself did not do anything. But translating into English. Now, with appointment as the guardian, he found himself a translator in a different sense, in a much wider, much broader sense. Not from one language to another, but from one world to another. A translation of the poetic, metaphoric, prophetic language of Baha'u'llah into the analytical, discursive, logical language of the 20th century. This is the task that Shoghi Effendi saw as his primary task. And these letters that he began sending, first group of letters that came in the 1920s were put together. They were mostly about laying down the foundation of the administration, the administrative order, and were published in, I think, 1928 under the name of Baha'i Administration. And then series of letters that, starting in late 1929, 1930, 31, up to 1936 or 7, I think, is the last of the letters in this volume that is called The World Order of Baha'u'llah. These are series of letters that he sent. To a large extent, and especially these three letters that we are to study with greater care, are translations of the poetic, metaphoric, prophetic language of Baha'u'llah into a language where a social critic, a philosopher, a thinker of our time would understand and would make sense to him. And in doing so, he really defined, delineated the whole shape of the world order of Baha'u'llah, and he clarified the fundamentals of our belief for us. This is really a task that required tremendous amount of focus, of prayer, of concentration. And here, I'd like to say a few things that may at first sit a little strangely in some of your ears or may not, because I have in my time come face to face with Baha'is, Baha'is of great understanding, much deeper than my understanding of the faith, of great stature, hands of the cause even, who claim for Shoghi Effendi things that neither Abdu'l-Bahá assigned to him nor Shoghi Effendi ever assumed to himself. It's in the nature of human beings when they are faced with something that is near to perfection to assign total powers to it. And people, I know some pilgrims, for example, who in his own presence threw himself at his feet and said, when I look at you, it's like I'm looking in the eyes of Baha'u'llah himself. And Shoghi Effendi's reaction was, Astaghfirullah, God forbid. And he would raise them and say, don't make such statements. And I know that some of these wonderful Baha'is have written their memoirs and their love of Shoghi Effendi carries to a point where they don't make clear the very points that Shoghi Effendi himself makes clear about who he is, what he does, and how these powers are devolved upon him. I don't want to get into a long discussion on the subject of infallibility, major or minor, and things like that. But it's important to, when we contemplate the breadth of vision, the acuity of judgment, the depth of analysis that he brings to the writings of the faith and relating that to the events of the world, that we don't assume that this is equivalent to divine revelation. This is expounding, which is what was his function assigned to him, to expound on the teachings, to translate or interpret in that more meaningful sense, not simply from one language to the other. Now, before I get into, there are some friends who want to go to another meeting, and I was told to end early. So before we get into the subject of the first of these letters, I was asked to share with you some of my recollections of meeting with Shoghi Effendi. The first time when I was 7.5 years old, I went there in company of my parents. And the second time, I was alone in December of 1955, when Sheila and I and Susan, our daughter, were pioneers in Greece. First time, it's 1934, Shoghi Effendi was in his early 40s, prime of life, to a young boy who stood probably half as tall as he did. He seemed like a tall and an erect person. On my second visit, those were two things that really crushed me. First, to see how he had stooped and how much he had aged, although he was not yet 60. Yet the weight of responsibilities and of the sufferings that he had gone through had made a considerable impact on his physical being. But at that time, the first time, as I say, a man in prime of life and with all the attributes of an athlete, which he was. You know, he was a good mountaineer. He had tremendous stamina. His usual mode of meeting with the pilgrims was to take them on hikes on Mount Carmel, which in those days was a bare mountain. You know, if you see photographs of Mount Carmel in the 1930s or earlier, you see that with the exception of the gardens surrounding the shrine building, that is not with the superstructure that it has today, but the original stone structure that Abdu'l-Bahá had built was the only thing that existed on the mountain. The rest of it was just bushes and stubble and rocks, and there were trails, hiking trails, that Shoghi Effendi used to take the pilgrims for a walk. And he obviously was in better shape than most of these pilgrims, because every once in a while he had to wait for them to catch their breath and be able to follow again. Even at that first time, the qualities that a 7.5-year-old boy could perceive, and there were qualities that were really impressed into my mind at my second pilgrimage, were two qualities that normally do not exist in the same person. And this was the really best that I can describe to you, the mysterious personality of Shoghi Effendi, in that he was a combination of utter meekness and gentleness with total power and authority. You don't normally see these two qualities at once in the same person, and the combination is absolutely overwhelming. You feel at once that you would like to sacrifice yourself for that meekness, for that gentleness. What Persian word would even describe it better? Mazlumiyat kubra. There's no way that I can translate that into English. And at the same time, you really were shaken to your roots with the authority that emanated from him. So these were the qualities. He spent the whole time that the pilgrims had the privilege of being in his presence commenting on the state of the world, on the condition of the Baha'i communities, on what they should do, essentially explicating things that about the same time he was putting into writing. I'm reading these world order letters, some of which are contemporary with the times that I happen to be there. And what I remember of his remarks are pretty much the subjects that he was discussing. I can tell you maybe something to a little amusing. You know, in Persia, it used to be customary when somebody came back from a pilgrimage, friends to gather together and to hear the news of this pilgrimage. And so this gentleman had returned from Haifa, and everyone was gathered at this meeting, and he started out by saying, I'll say it in Persian and then I'll try and translate it. He said, Hazrat Ali Amrullah khayli amriyan. He's Shoghi Effendi is very deeply involved with the faith, as if he expected. I was there for 9 days, and every day he spoke only about the faith. So, it's the fact. But you were lucky, you were privileged to be there and to hear him talk about it. In 1934, it was a time of changes in the homeland of faith, that is in Persia. Then government was making tremendous inroads into the powers of the Muslim clergy and was cutting off their hands from, you know, various. They, in the past, They were in charge of the judiciary and the educational system of the country, and both of these fundamental functions were taken away from them. And especially just a few months before that time that we were on pilgrimage, which was around Nowruz time, 1934, then Shah of Persia had decreed the removal of the veil from women, emancipation of women, unveiling. And of course, the mullahs had opposed it, and they were treated very roughly for their opposition. And when Shoghi Effendi asked my father, what's the condition of the Shi'i ulama, for example, in Persia, my father, with a great deal of glee, said, beloved guardian, they're finished. They're looking for holes in the ground to disappear into. And Shoghi Effendi laughed and he said, yes, but they will return with redoubled power and they will do much harm to the body of the faith, but they themselves will be the cause of triumph of the faith. Those were the remarks that he made in 1934. Now, this is, you don't have to take that as text. This is only a pilgrim's note. But when you read these letters, you hear Shoghi Effendi comment on events of the world and their relationship to the unfolding of the world order of Baha'u'llah. You see, oh my God, how prescient, how he must be talking about 2003. This can't be 1931, you know. And I bet you in 2083, when we read them again, we will say to ourselves that only now the real import of these remarks are becoming evident to us. So what he was saying in 1934 or what he was saying in 1955, again, 1934, the period between the two world wars, at the time when the world was getting ready for another great calamity, bigger than the first one, and 1955, when we were at the beginning of the terrible Cold War and things were getting more and more fearful in the world, he was saying things and we thought that we were hearing him or reading him and getting it, and yet when we reread now, this is one of the values of rereading of these letters, you realize how much of the potency, of the validity, of the timeliness of these messages are evolving, emerging in our lives. And this is one point that I would like to make, and perhaps some of you may have questions that I should leave some time for, is that when Shoghi Effendi speaks of the ordeals of the world, the calamity, the suffering that must bring about the realization of the human beings, invariably, most of us put these things in a very limited time frame. We think that he's talking about just now, you know, or when he was writing. Well, that time frame of the real sense of these letters is one that is expandable. That's one point that I want to leave with you, that it is not, none of these references are to any limited time or any limited event, that they're expandable. And number two point that I would like to leave with you is that these calamities that he speaks of, and very often catastrophes, we think of it as something that is going to be like a lightning bolt, that it will happen all over the place with one magnitude, and everyone will certainly feel it. And yet, you realize, the more carefully you read these letters, that these catastrophes are unfolding all the time, and they have impacts at in various ways that bring about precisely the results that he talks about. For example, he speaks in 1931 in that first letter about a Europe that has gone through the World War. It doesn't say First World War because the second one hadn't taken place yet, the Great War, the World War. Europe that is still full of hatred and full of feeling of revenge, that the peace treaty that the victors have imposed on the vanquished is unjust, is itself going to lead to greater conflict. And then he talks about the vision of the world order of Baha'u'llah, establishment of oneness of mankind, of course, as the ultimate and the central goal, but as part of its, you know, sort of necessary ingredients, greater integration of economy, the greater, I'd say, erasing of the national boundaries, the more reliance on a kind of collective security, and monetary, you know, unity of the currency, and so forth and so on. And you look at it and you see certainly the world is nowhere near the peace that we are looking for. And certainly the major problems, which are materialism and you know, racism and all the evils, are still with us. And yet, in sort of partial ways, some parts of the world are taking steps in those directions that he's talking about. Think of Europe of today and compare it with Europe of 1931. The two absolutely blood enemies of centuries, the Germans and the French, are the closest of allies today. The realization that you know, the sovereign nations should cede something to a larger sense of unity is taking root. A European Union has emerged, an economy that is interdependent. All of these things that he's talking about in these letters are happening. So what I'm saying is that don't expect a sudden grand ringing down of the old order and its quick emergence, the full world order of Baha'u'llah in one time, but things are coming about piecemeal, slowly, faster in some places than in others. And the understanding of this particularly is important for us if we are not to become discouraged or to be confused at this time. So, oh, wait for that calamity, you know, for the world to learn their lessons and come to the divine faith. That's not going, that's not how it's going to come about. Friends, I think that instead of now entering a more systematic review of these three letters, I should stop and respond to some of your questions, or if you like to hear some more stories or anything like that, I'd be happy to. Yeah. Does what I've been saying to you make sense so far? No? Yeah? All right. Yes. You want kind of vicarious pilgrimage. Sheila and I are always happy to be asked to relate the stories of our pilgrimages because it gives us a chance to relive those wonderful, beautiful, and unforgettable days. So I'm very happy to share with you more. And the two pilgrimages that I was privileged to be on, one in 1934 and one in 1955, were under such different circumstances, and that they're like two different chapters from a wonderful book. The first time, as I told you, was in springtime, Nowruz time, in fact. And to get to Haifa from Persia, we went all overland by car from Tehran to Baghdad, and by bus from Baghdad to Damascus, and by taxi from Damascus to Beirut, and by taxi from Beirut to Haifa. Mind you, the very route is impossible to pass now, because things, unlike removal of boundaries and the greater integration in Europe, this part of the world has become more divided, and hatreds have intensified. So I, for example, have recollections of traveling from Damascus to Beirut through the Baga Valley. What does that place bring to your mind now? It is a place that is associated in the news with terror and with murders and with abductions and kidnappings and so forth and so on. And yet the Baga Valley was the most beautiful orchard. And especially in that time of year, all the fruit trees in blossom. It was an enchanted time. And arriving in Beirut, you have to go up the Lebanese coastal range, covered with those cedars of Lebanon, which are real and which are there. And my first sight of the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, I'd never seen a sea before, landlocked Persian boy. So it was a wonderful experience. And this taxi delivered us right to the door of the master's house, number 7 Persian Street. And we knocked on the door, and the servant opened and ushered us into the house. Those of you who have been on pilgrimage, you know that you go up the stairs, you enter this octagonal central room, and immediately in front of you is a large sitting room which is fitted with sofas all around. It's called, in Arabic, it's called a mandar room. And we were ushered into this room, and on the left side, in the middle of the room on the sofa, was sitting the figure of a very dignified lady covered with a white headscarf. And when I say seated, I mean in the Persian style, charzanu, with her legs folded under her on top of the sofa, not hanging on the side. And my mother immediately recognized that this was Munira Khanum, the wife of Abdul Baha, who was still alive at the time. And so we greeted her and said Allah, and she in turn greeted us and welcomed us. And my first impression of a sound heard in the house of Abdul Baha was the voice of the grandmother of Shoghi Effendi speaking in the thickest Isfahani accent. And it was charming and amusing. And here she was, a lady who had been away from Isfahan for now near half a century, but her speech was just as authentic. And it was for this reason that later on we noticed that even Shoghi Effendi had a occasional tinge of Isfahani accent in when he spoke. For example, you say, "Intor shodes." Anyway, then from this room, we were served tea, and then some other ladies of the household, mother of Shoghi Effendi and one of his sisters, entered, and then we were ushered into the room immediately as you enter to the left, which had been the room of the greatest holy leaf. The greatest holy leaf had passed away a year and a half before this pilgrimage of ours. But that's the room in which Shoghi Effendi met all the arriving pilgrims for the first time by themselves, and also bade a farewell to them at the end of their pilgrimage, again by themselves in that room. The rest of the time, the pilgrims were in company of other pilgrims, and I will describe what the routines were. So we were led into this room, and Shoghi Effendi entered. My father's natural instinct was to sort of throw himself at the feet of Shoghi Effendi. And Shoghi Effendi immediately lifted him up and said, "No, no, no, that's not permissible." And he embraced him, and he greeted my mother, and he put his hand on my head. This was his greeting both at arrival and at departure time. And he said words of welcome and asked about the rigors of the journey, and said how pilgrims not so long ago used to come by on foot and would take months to get there, and now how easy it was to get to the Holy Land by car, and of course later on it got even easier to get there by airplane. And after these personal welcomes and greetings, he dismissed us, and we had to go to our respective pilgrim houses. In those days, the pilgrims from the east were not mixed with the pilgrims from the west. There was an eastern pilgrim house and a western pilgrim house. And it was for practical reasons as well as for some other the reasons were, after all, Haifa was a very traditional, restricted Muslim Arab city. And it was important not to defy too many of the norms of that particular culture, because God knows what kind of stories they would make about, sort of people coming from east and west and mixing together. Anyway, these were more practical than those were questions of language, because eastern pilgrims were met at a different time by Shoghi Effendi, and there he spoke to them in Persian or Arabic or occasionally even Turkish. But for the Western pilgrims, depending on whether they were English-speaking or French-speaking, in their own language. Furthermore, the times of pilgrimage were not the same either. In 1934, the Eastern pilgrims were permitted to stay 19 days as guests of Shoghi Effendi, and the Western pilgrims were there for 9 days. Life in the West is a little more accelerated, and therefore their pilgrimage was shorter. It's not that the Persian or Eastern pilgrims deserve longer time to remain, but they usually had come a more arduous way, and they were not dismissed that early. And besides, the 19 days was a considerable curtailment of the previous unlimited time of pilgrimage. When people went in times of Abdul Baha, they stayed until they were told that now it was time to go. Sometimes it was weeks and months. And some of those pilgrims who had the nerve took advantage of that. One of them is supposed to have said to Abdul Baha, when he sensed that he was about to be dismissed, he said, "Abdul Baha, I know that my time is coming to a close, but I have one request, that you give me 6 months advance notice before you dismiss me." So Abdul Baha laughed and said, "6 months, 6 weeks, 6 days, 6 hours, what difference does it make? You may go tomorrow." So it was nine, this was the reason. And then also, the Eastern pilgrim men and women were not housed in the same way, nor did their times of meeting with the Guardian, the same. The building known as the Old Eastern Pilgrim House by the Shrine of the Bab, built by the grandfather of the gentleman that I see sitting in the audience there, that was for Ghazanfar. I'm talking, you know, the rest of them don't know you, but it was his grandfather who constructed that building there. And that was for men in those days. And women were housed in rooms in the house adjacent to House of Abdu'l-Bahá himself. Those of you who have been on pilgrimage in recent times, you notice that the House of Abdu'l-Bahá is number 7. Then number 9 is a music academy. And number 11, again, is belongs to the faith and is occupied by a member of the House of Justice. Well, those two houses, 9 and 11, were built the same time or shortly after number 7 by Abdu'l-Bahá for two of his daughters who, with their husbands who lived there. And there were rooms in the area which is in the number 9 now where Eastern women stayed. And I, at the age of 7 and a half, was in a rather advantageous amphibious state. I could stay either with my father or with my mother, and I very quickly found that it was good to take full advantage of that amphibian status, because by staying during the day with my father, I could be there when Shoghi Effendi came to see the Eastern men pilgrim every day, and by spending nights with my mother, I could be there on some nights when Shoghi Effendi called the women back to the house of the master for you know, spend time with them. So that was the routine. Now with the men, he came usually about 4 o'clock in the afternoon to the shrine or to the entrance by the shrine, and of course all the men were waiting for him, standing already outside the pilgrim house. And he would arrive from his house, and we would greet him, and then he would proceed to walk on Mount Carmel, and everyone behind him, and in this fashion, and he would talk. Every once in a while he would stop and turn back and ask someone a question, but this was the mode of being in his presence for Eastern men. And when I say Eastern, I want to emphasize that sometimes we Persians think that we were the only Eastern Baha'is. That's not so. There were pilgrims from Iraq and from India and from Egypt at the same time there. So Shoghi Effendi spoke to them, to the Arab friends in Arabic. And I might share with you also that he spoke Arabic, spoken Arabic fluent in the Palestinian Arabic pronunciation, just the Arabic of the place where he grew up. But when he chanted the Tablet of Visitation in the shrines, and I'll tell you about that, the tablets are in Arabic, you know. He chanted with a Persian pronunciation and in a Persian musical mode. I say this for some of my Persian friends who every once in a while try to gutturalize their Arabic and imitate Arabic, to tell you that in a way, the practice of using Arabic with Persian pronunciation is a deep-rooted one in the Baha'i community. And in a sense, really, Arabic is not a foreign language or should not be a foreign language for Persian Baha'is. This is what Shoghi Effendi insisted on. I remember on one of the nights when I was there with my mother and other women from the East, Shoghi Effendi's mother said to Shoghi Effendi that this child, meaning me, knows some prayers by heart. May he chant one. And Shoghi Effendi said, go ahead. And I chanted one in Persian. And after it was finished, he said, now you must memorize one in Arabic. And so I, of course, immediately set to work to do that. So back to walking and speaking in Persian and in Arabic. And after these walks were, as I said, topics of the day having to do with development of the faith and how the events of the world interacted with the state of the Baha'i communities. These were themes of his conversations. Then at the end of this walk, we would come back to the shrines, that is the Shrine of the Bab and Shrine of Abdu'l-Bahá, which are adjacent. And interchangeably, first day at the Shrine of the Bab, next day Shrine of Abdu'l-Bahá, and alternately that way. He himself would, he would remove his shoes, and as we did all, and then he would stand at the entrance of the shrine with the container of rose water. And each one of us, as we entered, he offered some rose water. We cupped our hands and we poured some rose water in our hands. And then we went in, and then after we were all in, he himself came in and went and stood before the shrine, and he chanted the Tablet of Visitation. And dear friends, perhaps the most memorable, the most affecting memory of both of these pilgrimages for me are hearing the voice of Shoghi Effendi chant the Tablet of Visitation, because he had a heavenly, beautiful, melodious voice, and he had a way of chanting that was really unique. You never, were conscious that he was doing anything to embellish or, ornament the voice. All the emphasis was on the meaning of the words and the raising and the dynamics of the chanting all brought out the inner meaning of the things. And there are passages in that Tablet of Visitation that to this day, whether they're said in the original Arabic or I hear it in translation in English, I only hear his voice in my ears, and even to this day, I get goosebumps is the best way that I can describe to you. It was an unforgettable experience. Then at the end of this, he would come out, and some days he would just dismiss us. He would say goodbye and return to the master's house. Or on some days, he would ask the attendants, the gardeners, which in those days, in that first time that I was there, without any exception, were descendants of Yazdi Baha'is of Zoroastrian background. And I remember the one who was in charge at the gardens around the shrine, was his name was Khosrow. He would say, Khosrow, bring some chairs and some tea from the pilgrim house. And the chairs would be set in the garden right in front of the shrine, and we would be served tea, and he would continue the discourse on that occasion until the time that he wanted to leave. So I will share with you one interesting episode out of that first pilgrimage. I remember the very first day of our pilgrimage when he came out of the shrine and he asked Khosrow to bring chairs, and he was sitting down there. He said that the interior of the shrines of the Shrine of the Bab was electrified during the last year of Abdu'l-Bahá's life already. But now he wanted to set up a floodlight outside so that at night it would highlight the shrine and the heart of Mount Carmel. And my father got his courage together and said, "Beloved guardian, may I be permitted to contribute the cost of this project?" And Shoghi Effendi very kindly said, fine, he accepted that. And that was the end of that. Well, setting up floodlights, after all, how long it's going to take. You know, we thought that in any day we would see these the lights set on, but 19 days were coming too close, and there was no sign of any activity there. Apparently, there had been some delay in the arrival of the ship with the equipment or release of the equipment from customs. Anyway, it wasn't done. Our 19 days were coming to a close, and Shoghi Effendi said to my father a couple of days before the end of the 19 days, he said that you are not to go back directly home. I'm sending you on a mission. I want you to go to Egypt on my behalf to visit. And he mentioned five different Baha'i communities, Cairo, Alexander, Ismailia, Aswan, and Port Said. He said, you go and visit these Baha'i communities, give them my greetings, encourage them, this, that, and the other, and then come back and report to me. You know? So this was a wonderful thing of extending, you know, the pilgrimage. And so we went, and in those days, the way to go from Haifa to Egypt was by train. In Haifa, we got on the railroad and went across the Sinai Desert and crossed the Suez Canal and into Egypt. And we had a wonderful couple of weeks in Egypt, where all of these communities were visited. And very little did my father know that this was a kind of a harbinger of his destiny, that after all, Egypt is on the continent of Africa, and that was where a later directive of the Guardian, not directly to him, since the Baha'is, he encouraged Baha'is to pioneer to Africa, and my father was one of the first to respond to that call and went there, and he ended up remaining there to the end of his life. Anyway, this Egyptian episode, when it came to an end, we returned to Haifa to report. And he assumed, my father assumed, that now we'll be dismissed and we go back. But Shoghi Effendi said, now you are new pilgrims. You may stay another 19 days. So, of course, we were delighted. And now we had come at Nowruz time. This was now past even Rizwan, and the days were getting longer. Shoghi Effendi came as usual around 4, and at most he stayed to about 5:30. Then one day, in the middle of this second pilgrimage, he took us for the longest walk on Mount Carmel. It was never that long before, and everyone began to wander towards the end. So why is it that Shoghi Effendi is taking so long? Good 2 hours of walk on the mountain. He took us to the head of the mountain and then to where overlooking the cave of Elijah and the Catholic convent that is on the hill. Those. And by the time we were back and into the shrines, we thought for sure now he would leave right away. But lo and behold, we come out, and he asked Khosrow to bring chairs and sit up there. And again, for longer than ever before, so long until it actually got dark. And when it was dark enough, he gave a signal, a sort of subtle signal to Khosrow, and those lights went on for the first time. And he looked with a smile, almost a childish, delighted smile at my father. It occurred to him, and you know, I was too young to put all of these things together. But my father told me that at that moment, he thought that maybe the whole scheme of extending the pilgrimage and going to Egypt and so forth was that he would be there to see this insignificant contribution that he had made. And he said that this was really the Guardian. And it's so true that you took the smallest step for him, and he repaid you 1,000 times with praise and approval and love. And that was really Shoghi Effendi. That's how he held the Baha'i world together. That is how he propelled the Baha'i world into all these great achievements. Well, I'll leave something about the next pilgrimage for the next session.